This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, B-17s are going to face a rough summer with a new AD.
And the NTSB denies an appeal by YouTube pilot Trent Palmer.
Also, a new acronym to learn, VARMA, but maybe it's going to save us some money.
We're going to find out who won the best flight school and instructor recognized at Redbird Migration.
All right, David, you ready to do some hangar talk?
Let's do it, Ian.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4. Turn right, contact
30. With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
I'm David Tulitz.
David, our guest is Jason Capra. Jason is, speaking of warbirds, actually, Jason's the man. He has gathered tons of volunteers and raised funds and all sorts of incredible work to restore a C-54.
Which is similar to a DC-3, and it's up in Pennsylvania. We took a trip up there with Michelle Walker and Colin Callahan, and thanks to both of them for conducting the interview.
Yeah. So we'll have him a little later on. But first, talking about this B-17 AD. So this is something that's just come out. We're just getting some kind of sketch details now. AVWEB had an initial story, which is really good. The basic idea is, I guess I hadn't realized how few are left flying. I mean, I knew it wasn't a ton, obviously, but we're down to just a few. And it appears that all of them will be grounded, at least for the foreseeable future, because of an AD that's probably going to come out.
Yeah, Ian. There are only two, potentially three, four at the max at this point. We got two flying in the United States. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the Yankee Air Museum has a Yankee lady. And there's another one in the Commemorative Air Force's fleet called Sentimental Journey. Mm-hmm. You know, those are flying. Erickson Aircraft Collections have Old Pub, OLD Pub.
Yeah, that's one I haven't seen.
Right, and not flying right now is one that I've flown in, which is the Aluminum Overcast, operated by the EAA. And there's one overseas as well that's flying. But so, Ian, the problem is a spar issue. The fuselage side shear spar terminal area, and that is a big deal. That is, in fact, what grounded the Aluminum Overcast over in Punta Gorda, Florida in 2021.
Yeah. So apparently there was an AD back in 2001 about some spar inspections related to these airplanes, but this AD, you're right, it's not confirmed yet because it is obviously a small community, and I think probably the people who are involved know, but not the rest of us are going to learn this in pieces as it comes out. But what grounded the Aluminum Overcast, right, it's not necessarily even the wing spar portion of the spar. It's the fuselage attach points. There's three attach points, and I guess there's just some stuff they're going to have to work out there. But they know that once this AD comes out, it will they think that at a minimum, all the airplanes are going to be down for the summer season.
Well, part of the problem with that, Ian, is the way that that structure was designed, the way that spar was designed. I read a little bit further on it, as you probably did, too. And, you know, when Boeing designed that back in, you know, 70 some odd years ago, nowadays it's hard to have the tooling to redesign that fitting and that fixture and the way that it tapers right into that area.
Yeah.
And that is a big problem right now, is how to retrofit something new, you know, to go into something that has that kind of age on it.
Yeah, that's right. So good luck to them as they work through that. Hopefully we'll have them back for the following season. All right, want to talk about Trent Palmer.
Who doesn't want to talk about Trent Palmer?
Yeah. Yeah, these days, it's a big subject. So this is something I think if people remember, we talked about I don't even know, a year ago maybe when his suspension came up. He appealed, I think it was 120 days, the initial suspension for some low flying. He appealed, it was knocked back. The FAA appealed that, and boy, he's back to square one now with the NTSB.
And you know what, Ian? The flight occurred back in 2019, so this has been working its way through the system for a pretty good while. So just to refresh folks' memory, Trent Palmer, who has a pretty big audience on YouTube, and he does try to practice safe flying. He's one of the folks that explains what he's doing, and he's very methodical about it, but he decided to land at a friend's house, a homeowner's backyard, and he made a low pass to check the area out, and it happened to be the wrong place to make a low pass, just to keep it short and sweet. The neighbors were unhappy with Trent's performance.
Yeah, so he obviously has a ton of experience flying backcountry, and one of the things you do, like you said, is you'll do a low pass, sometimes a medium and a high pass, sometimes a medium and a low. He mentioned the FAA's own guidance in doing that, which he's right. And I can tell you just from the helicopter training, they do the same thing, right? You have to do, you do kind of an upper recon looking for in and out routes, obstructions, emergency landing sites. Then you come down lower, looking at wind keys, the landing site, that sort of thing. He, on this one, flew about 100 feet and apparently went over some houses, a propane tank. It was in pursuit of an eventual landing. However, he did he decided not to land, which I wonder if that hurt him in this case.
Might have. It might have, because if he landed, then you could go ahead and say that that was in the process of landing.
Yeah, whereas now they just sort of have to take his word for it. Also, I just can't imagine that this didn't factor in. He has been in trouble with the FAA before, and I got to think that they just saw what they felt like, not saying that we feel this way, but that they felt was sort of a repeated pattern of behaviors.
And as is typical in some of these cases like this, and we've talked about a few others on Hangar Talk through the years, you know, the FAA cited the careless and reckless operation that is CFR 91.13 that can get all of us in trouble if we're not careful. And specifically, minimum safe altitudes, being closer than 500 feet to any person, vessel, vehicle, or structure, except when necessary for takeoff or landing.
Yeah. And I think the takeaway here for the rest of us is, just because you can do something, right? He had the homeowner's permission to land there.
He did.
There's nothing that says we can't land off airport. It doesn't mean that it's always going to be looked upon positively by neighbors, which is important.
Especially non-flying neighbors.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep. Or other people who aren't involved in these sort of activities. So just because you can doesn't mean you should necessarily.
Right.
Although I get people have counter arguments. And you, you know, you pointed this out. When you read the complaint, which AvWeb has on its website, it's really good actually. You can, it's hundreds of pages, but it goes into a lot of detail. You can tell there was some, maybe a little animosity there already between the neighbors, and at least it appears so, and no doubt that also factored into it.
The wrong place at the wrong time, Ian. And, you know, and then this day and age, you've got doorbell cameras and everything else, so got to be careful. And we'll be right back.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52.
So moving on, as you like to say.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk a little bit about the yet another acronym, VARMA?
VARMA,
And it sounds like something you'd be seeing on TV, the VARMA effect.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's right.
It's really cool, though, the Vintage Aircraft Replacement and Modification article program. And Ian, you and I both have airplanes that we would now be considered vintage aircraft made before 1980. Weighing less than 12,500 pounds. So we both can be a participant in the VARMA program.
Yeah. So this just came out, about a couple of days ago, I guess now. Something that EAA has been working on, I know, and put out some announcements around it. The basic idea is, I mean, we, you know, NORSI, which is where you can put in safety equipment that doesn't necessarily have to be certified, but you can do with a minor repair, you know, minor alteration, I mean, with a logbook entry. This, I guess, maybe expands that a little bit, I would say. I don't think that's technically what's going on, but, you know, for all intents and purposes. EAA got a, for example, a starter approved under this program, an off-the-shelf starter, and got it approved. And they think there's ways to get other elements like that, like alternators and other NVFR aircraft and other sort of non-flight safety critical items.
Certain types of certificated aircraft, not experimental aircraft, but certificated aircraft, can use a number of non-flight critical, like you said, off-the-shelf parts, without the need for new regulations, orders, or advisory circulars. And the key to this is that the part has to have already demonstrated, you know, proper use or equivalent use, Ian, if you will, in other installations, and has to still meet certain standards.
Yeah.
So it's not a complete carte blanche, but the FAA may accept previously approved article submission substitutions, I'm reading now from the actual order, if the part or the material is installed with a previously approved data set, including an STC, a PMA, a TSO, or a field approval, etc., and it's completed in a similar manner consistent with the previous approval. So that's a lot of words to say. If someone has put this particular part, could be, like you said, a starter, alternator, generator in my case, on an aircraft, and maybe it's a newer version of the part that was out in 1953, as long as there's data to support it, we can go ahead and use that particular newer part, because sometimes you can't get older parts. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I think there's a lot to be learned here about exactly what the impact's going to be on this and how big and how widespread. It obviously requires your mechanic's buy-in because he or she needs to do that sign-off and needs to make that determination.
Yes.
So that's, I think, a big deal. But it does, you know, maybe companies will be cheaper for them to put stuff out because they get the STC on one type maybe and you can apply it to other types. I don't know.
Perhaps so. Yeah. I need a radio upgrade. Let's be honest. I mean, I've got a little, I could do with a radio and GPS upgrade in the mighty Tri-Pacer. And I, you know, found that out during my 2,400-mile journey.
Yeah.
Yes. But that's not a starter, and it's not an alternator. But
maybe a second radio.
Okay,
yeah.
There you go. And there's still a process, Ian. It's like a 7-step process. You still have to submit a letter. You need a certifying statement. You need quality reassurance and product design and other parameters, which folks could read about online. But nonetheless, there is a road to an improvement process.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we want to finish up with some great news, a fun announcement. This is something that we do every year at AOPA, and that is award the best flight school and instructor awards in the country. That just happened at Redbird Migration, and actually this is, a new thing for us, and that is there's a repeat best flight school winner.
Yeah, Ian, and you got a chance to talk to the folks at In the Pattern from Texas before, and congratulations to the Gardners, Sherman and Darren, and also Chris Webb from In the Pattern. I met them last year in 2022. They were great, and they are repeat winners for the best flight school. And, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds of schools and instructors that are nominated by students and their peers, and they have to go through a pretty strict kind of vetting process. But nonetheless, we look at all these schools, we look at all these instructors, and the whole goal for the program, Ian, is to get better instruction for students or for folks who are transitioning to a different rating or trying to add like a multi-engine or something like that.
Yeah.
So Ian, now who is the best CFI?
Okay, so that's Brian Goutre. I believe he's from the Upper Midwest and the University of Dubuque, I think, actually in Iowa. So I was in part of the team that selected the winner for CFI. And I can tell you, so just a little bit of, you know, behind the scenes of how this stuff works.
Yeah.
So these are all customer-based reviews. Customers, they go on, they take the survey for the school and the instructor, and they put in all this really detailed information about community and teaching effectiveness and value and using syllabus and simulation and all kinds of stuff. And then they do open responses. And so Chris Moser, who we see on the screen now, and his team, they crunch all the number parts and give us, you know, the top candidates in each region. And then we go through and read all the open responses and start to get the winners from there. And I can tell you that it is so much fun to read these responses and see how good flight training can be and what a difference it can make in people's lives. It can be this, as you and I know, a life-changing experience. And certainly when Brian interacts with his students, I mean, you can just see it in the responses and you can see the excitement and you can feel it. It's so cool. I love doing it. But we don't know who these people are. I mean, there's no names, no schools, no nothing. And it's all completely done blind. So it's exciting for us too, because we get to see when it's announced, essentially, who this person is that we voted on. So we have no idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And the interesting thing about it is that, just to reiterate, the survey encourages anyone who has taken flight training in the past 12 months to candidly share their training experience. And that really brings it into folks who are taking their first lesson to folks who are going for a commercial pilot certificate or an instrument rating, you know, yeah. Folks with a little bit, you know, a little more seasoning under their belts. But it's all about how good the training is and how you react with your flight instructor.
Yep, that's right.
It's a very positive thing. And like we said, we're trying to make flight training better all the time. And that's just one tool in AAPA's tool belt that hopefully will help a lot of other pilots down the road.
Yep, absolutely. So before we move on to Jason and the guest segment, I want to go through and just talk about the regional winners.
Okay.
So the best school and instructor of the year are chosen from the list of the best regional winners.
Okay.
So we go through this process twice, essentially. We go through and pick the best of the region, and then from those regional winners, we pick the best overall. And so I just want to read the instructors. I'll let you do this. So Brian, of course, was the regional of the Central Southwest from Dubuque, Iowa. The Eastern region was Doug O'Clair from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. The Great Lakes was Logan Arliss. He's from the Chicago area. Northwest Mountain was William Dale Crabtree from Everett, Washington. Southern was Brandon Gardner from the Orlando area. And the Western Pacific was William Cole Hickox from Scottsdale.
And like we said earlier, congratulations again to the best flight school in the Central Southwest region in the pattern from Denton, Texas, who we've met before, and they've been on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern region, the North Virginia pilots or NOVA pilots from Leesburg, Virginia, not too far from AAPA headquarters.
Yeah.
In the Great Lakes, a repeat regional winner, Blue Skies Flying Services.
They are repeat.
Out of Chicago, that's right, out of Chicago and Lake in the Hills, Illinois. Northwest Mountain Region, Ridgeline Aviation out of Bozeman, Montana.
Mm-hmm.
Another repeat name from the South, the Southern Region, Mill 2 ATP from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Yep.
And Western Pacific, Bush Air from Calnev, Arizona. I don't know. I can't pronounce it. Calnev, Arizona.
Never heard of that.
Nevada.
Calnev, Ari, Nevada. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Somebody who listens from that town, please tell us where that
must be on the border is all I can figure out.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah. So
well, congratulations to all the regional winners. And Ian, thank you for reading their names. That was fantastic.
Yeah. Thanks to all the winners for showing up. And yeah, congratulations. So, all right, David, Jason Capra, man, again, the amount of work that goes into these restoration projects, I mean, you can only imagine. So really excited to have him on and hear what goes into it.
I've wanted to be a pilot since I can remember. I've been obsessed with airplanes since I think I was 5 is my first recollection of wanting to be a pilot and be involved in aviation. I grew up next to the Washington County Airport south of Pittsburgh. So I lived right underneath the pattern for the airport. So I see airplanes going over every day as a child and just was mesmerized by them. I used to go out with my grandparents all the time to Pittsburgh International Airport when I was a kid. We used to watch airplanes land there all the time. And again, it was just everything was constantly reconfirming that I should probably be flying these things one day. Took my first airplane ride when I was 14 years old. It was an orientation flight. Went up for about an hour or so with an instructor at the airport right by my house. I lived about 2 miles away from the Washington County Airport in south of Pittsburgh. And I loved it. I already knew I wanted to do it, but being in that airplane was just solidified that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I remember telling my dad when I got home that day, I said, I want to learn how to fly. And he said, that's great, but you know, we don't have the money to pay for lessons. We can't help you. So you've got one of two options. Either you can go to the military or you can get a job. Well, I didn't want to wait. So the next day I rode my bike back down to the airport and I went back up to the flight school and I said, I want to learn how to fly. I don't have any money. What can I do to pay for these lessons? And the guy said, well, I own the charter company too, and I need someone actually to clean the hangar and clean the airplanes at night if you'd be interested. So I said, absolutely. Are you kidding me? I'm going to get to clean airplanes? So he's like, yeah. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, all the money you make, we'll put in an account. That way you don't get to spend it on frivolous things, but we'll put it towards flight lessons and we'll go that way. He's like, I'll even be your instructor, you know. So that's how I got started. I started cleaning airplanes. I'd go up there four nights a week and scrub Navajos and Cessna 340s and all the flight school airplanes. And all the money I made went towards my flying lessons. And I started flying when I was 15 years old.
Nice. Yeah. How old are you now?
38.
You fly for?
Republic Airways. And I'm based in Pittsburgh. I've worked there for 16 years now.
So tell me about Beach City Baby and how you first found the airplane.
So it was purely accidental that I found the airplane. I was actually driving home from ground school for Republic Airways, which is in Indianapolis, Indiana. And I usually drive out just because it's easier. As soon as I'm done with training, I'm in my truck and I'm on my way home. But I just got tired of being on the interstate. And I think it was right around Columbus, Ohio. I was like, I'm just going to take back roads home to Pittsburgh and see what I find. I don't even know why I did. But I got off the highway in Columbus and started backtracking my way to Pittsburgh, and I came, it was like 2 hours later, I came through this little area, and it said Beach City, Ohio, and I never heard of it before. And I remember coming around the bend, and there was all these houses, and I saw hangars next to them, and I was like, oh, this is really cool, this must be a flying community. And I was trying to look to see if I could see any airplanes sitting out and stuff, and I'll never forget seeing the sign for the airport. And then there's a row of open air hangars. And then at the end of that hangar, I saw the tail of this thing. And it was this silver rudder with a white vertical stabilizer, and it was all torn and tattered. And I looked at it and I was like, is that seriously a DC-3? And came down the road, and sure enough, there she was sitting there, and just the most pitiful looking DC-3 you've ever seen. Just mold and fungus growing on it, and all kind of dirt and debris all over it, and the windows were all delaminated and frosted over, and I mean, tires were rotting into the ground, and I mean, my heart just broke, but I was like, holy crap. Like, so I pulled my truck over and I went over and just walked around this thing and was looking at it, and I was like, how can this just be sitting here rotting away like this? I remember writing the end number down, and I looked everywhere to see if there was somebody around that day I could talk to, and there was nobody there. I remember walking up to the airplane, and I don't even know why I said this, but I said, I'm going to do something to save you. You deserve more than this. I'll be back. And I remember giving the prop a hug and just like walked to my truck, and I just kept staring at it, and I drove away. I don't even know what that meant, but I was just going to do something. I think it was first I was just going to find out what the history of it was and try and put it in touch with someone that might be able to do something. But I never thought that it would lead to, you know, it sitting here behind me right now. So,
yeah, so what was that? I mean, you bought it.
So I actually put the initial payment down on it to hold it. The owner did not want to sell the airplane at all. I finally figured out who that was, got in touch with him, and I asked if it was for sale or if he'd be interested in selling it, and he said, no, it's not for sale, not at all. I must have kept after him for 3 or 4 months, just calling and, hey, are you sure you don't want to sell this airplane? Like, what are you going to do with it? It's just sitting there rotting away. And he's like, well, what are you going to do with it? And I said, well, I'd like to restore it and fly it. You know, I think that's what you wanted, but I know enough people and I've been involved with Warbirds. And I said, I think I might be able to actually do what you've always wanted to see happen to it. And I said, I just need you to give me a chance. So we went back and forth, and he finally came up with a price. And he said, I'll tell you what. He said, I'll sell it to you for $100,000, which was more than, at that time, an airworthy DC-3 was going for. And I was like, well, when am I ever going to have a chance to do this? You know, and it is a little steep, and I got a lot of money I got to put into it still. But I said, I told him, I said, I can't give you $100,000 right now. I don't have it. And I said, but I can give you what I have. And if you give me time, I'll come up with the rest somehow. And he's like, well, what do you got? And honestly, at the time, I only had about $25,000 in my savings account. I said, I've got $25,000 to my name. And he's like, you give me the $25,000, I'll give you a year to come up with the rest. So that was the deal. I gave him every penny I had. I literally went broke in a day. Like, I had nothing. But he had my money, and I had 1 year to come up with the rest of the money to get this thing, or he kept this and my money. So I went to work. I formed a 501c3 nonprofit, which took about a month and a half. I knew nothing about that. Researching it, talking to people that have done it, got that up and running. And as soon as I got my paper from the IRS saying that we were a legal nonprofit, then I went to work on trying to fundraise. And I went to every business I could think of, every person I could think of, said, hey, look, you know, I'm trying to save this airplane. We just need some help financially. Would you be interested in being a sponsor? And I came up with different sponsorship packets and donor packets to, you know, go with it. But that's how we fundraised it. It took us almost a year to the date. I was getting really nervous because it was coming down to the wire. But about a month or two before that 1 year, I came up with the remaining money and we paid cash for this. So, which was a great day, but now I owned a DC-3 in the middle of nowhere in Ohio that hadn't flown in 24 years. So now it's like, okay, how are we gonna get this out of here? And I didn't even know where it was gonna go. You know, originally we were thinking about taking it down to Washington County Airport, which is where I'm from, which is south of Pittsburgh. But there's no hangars there big enough for this thing. And then that's when Uncle Jim, Aaron, said, you know, there's hangars up in Franklin that are empty and vacant, I think would be big enough to fit this in. And this hangar and then the one next door were empty. And we ended up talking with the county commissioners up here, and they said, if you can get it here, we'll work a deal out with you for rent, you know. So we kind of had an idea of what we were going to pay once we got it here. And again, as you can see, this hangar is big enough that it works very well for what we're doing in here. But we just had to get it here now. That was the fun part, was trying to, again, get all the fundraising and talk businesses and other individuals into believing in what we were doing. But we did. We, you know, we kind of put a game plan together of what we needed to do to get it flyable. And we just, you know, part by part, started knocking those items off the checklist. And the whole time while we were doing that, I was fundraising money and going to every business and person I could think of that might be able to help us out and asked for help.
And this is your first airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Most people would not pick a non-flying twin-engine radial as their first airplane.
Right.
What was that like for you when you started telling people you knew that you were buying a DC-3?
I think they thought I was out of my mind. I still think I'm out of my mind. But had I not been involved with the Berlin Airlift Historical Foundation and flying and working on the DC-4, which is a four-engine Douglas transport, I don't know that I would have had the confidence to take this on. I knew what it took to keep that one going, and the owner of that airplane always told me, anybody can operate a DC-3. Operating a DC-4 takes something special. And I was like, well, I've been involved with this for a while. I know what he's doing, so maybe I can do it. Maybe I can, I've learned enough here that I could try this on my own and try and save another airplane. And that's what gave me the confidence to go and do it. There was a lot of times where I was scared to death. There was a lot of unknowns, and I still wasn't sure how this was going to work out, but I just figured if I kept going forward and kept trying, that the right people would come along and it would pan out somehow.
What was the condition of the airplane when you actually purchased it?
Non-flying. There wasn't anything on this airplane that worked at all. You know, we were afraid that the engines weren't even going to turn over, you know, but again, working on the C-54 and asking the people who had been working on that to help inspect this and make sure the engines were okay and kind of get them going again helped out tremendously. And after having about three or four experienced people look at it saying, you got a good airplane here and just needs woken up, you know, there's nothing wrong with these engines, it was the confidence I needed to hear to make that work.
When you bought it, obviously it didn't fly. How far away is Beach City from here? How did you get out there to actually work on it and find help?
So from here, it's about a 2-hour drive due west. we drove out there 2 to 3 days a week. You didn't really have a choice. You know, we didn't know anybody out there. Hotel rooms were too expensive. So during the winter, when it was cold, we would drive 2 to 3 days a week back and forth. And, you know, you'd get up at 4 or 5 a.m. and drive the 2 hours out there, work all day, and then drive 2 hours home and get up and do it all over again the next day. Then it got to the point, too, where we would actually just start getting hotel rooms out there, just so we didn't have to drive back and forth all the time. In the summer, when it was warm enough, I actually camped out underneath the airplane a lot. Like, I had a tent, and there'd be about 3 or 4 of us in different pop-up tents underneath the airplane, and we'd be there Saturday through Sunday.
How long did it take for you to get it into flight, at least flying condition enough to bring it here?
So ferryable, it took about 4 years to the point where we could ferry it here. And like I said, that was almost 2 to 3 days a week for 4 years straight working on it. Then once we got it here, there was people up here constantly throughout the week. I myself would be up here 2 to 3 days a week working on it, but there was always somebody here almost every day doing something on it for almost 4 years.
How big of a crew did you have at that point?
I'd say consistently working on it, there's probably about 15 people that were religiously here all the time.
What year did you buy it?
2017, I think, is when we put the down payment on it. We outright owned it in 2018.
Okay, and was 2022 the year that it actually was show-worthy?
Yes. Yeah, so 2022 was the first year that it flew fully restored. And then that was, last year was also the first year we took it to air shows as a flying warbird. So we did, I think, 13 events last year, and we put close to 30 hours on the airplane.
What was it like to see it fly for the first time after you finished the rest of it?
I was actually the one flying it, so I was in it. And it didn't hit me until halfway through the post-restoration flight that we were flying it. I was so focused on just every aspect of being a good test pilot at that point, you know, sticking to engine parameters and temperatures and watching everything, that it wasn't until I think our second or third lap around the airport that it actually hit me that I could just sit back and it's like, well, we're flying it and it's done. Like, you know, it's restored. We did what we set out to do. It was just an awe-inspiring moment. Still speechless, you know, but even the ferry flight over here, that was even more tense because we still had to do a lot of work on it. And it was a lot of just minimum touching the engines, you know, set it and forget it type things, and straight and level, and let's just get there, you know, and let's hope everything keeps running for the next 45 minutes. And I knew it would. I knew structurally, like I said, the history of the design, you know, it was one of the most sturdy airframes ever built, but, you know, there's still a lot of unknown that was at the time. So it was exciting, exhilarating, but it was also stressful, too, getting it over here.
When you got the airplane, what was the configuration? Because I assume it didn't have the medical stretchers in it.
No. When we got the airplane, it was stripped. It was empty. The only thing that was in there were plywood bulkheads and plywood floors. And they were so badly dry rotted that if you stepped on the floors, your foot went right through. And same thing with the bulkheads. Just from being in a temperate climate for almost 30 years sitting outside and all the mildew and rot that was going on, you could put your hands against it and just push the bulkheads in and you'd hear them crack. So all that had to be replaced and stuff. So, but we were lucky we had all the original drawings for a C-53. So we were able to completely reconstruct all the bulkheads and floorboards right back to the way they were.
Can you tell me a little bit about the history of this airframe, when it was built?
So this airplane was originally constructed as a C-53. It was started in late 1941 and was actually on the factory floor when we were attacked at Pearl Harbor in December 7th, 1941. The airplane was drafted finally by the military in January of 42. It was designated a C-53 Skytrooper, and its first assignment was to Ferry Command, which was the forerunner to Air Transport Command. The airplane was assigned to civilian crews being flown for the military. So originally it went over, it was assigned in Presque Isle, Maine, and it flew the North Atlantic track over to England. This airplane is one of the first aircraft to lay the groundwork for that, for the rest of the bombers and fighters to get over there. Flew with the pilots of Northeast Airlines under Air Transport Command for years. And then in late 1942, the aircraft then went to the North African Division of Air Transport Command and was used heavily in the North African campaign, moving troops, supplies, materials in and out of that continent. Then later in 1943 and 44, the airplane then was involved in the invasion of Sicily, and then it was also involved in the invasion of Italy. But yeah, so it was used a lot as well as a hospital ship. So that was one of the other neat stories that we have intertwined into the interior of the aircraft is this airplane was used by some of the first Army air nurses, female Army air nurses in our military's history. So we have a section of the cabin of the interior of the aircraft that is set up with the stretchers the way they would have been when they were evacuating wounded troops. And we really wanted to tell that story about the Army air nurses as well and how instrumental they were to saving lives and bringing soldiers home. But this aircraft, the C-53s especially, were heavily used in that capacity. So it's a really neat part of the story we get to tell.
And after the war, what did the plane do?
So after World War II, the aircraft was sold surplus. It went to Danish Airlines, flew as an airliner with Danish Airlines for a little while, and then Danish Airlines became SAS. So it flew for Scandinavia. It was called the Gorm Viking. And it was polished aluminum, and it had a big dragon that was painted on the fuselage, and it would have actually Gorm Viking right where Beach City Baby is, but it was all polished aluminum. Did that till 1953 or 54. Was sold again, came back to the United States, and then it was converted into a corporate DC-3. Flew for a couple companies out of Florida at that time, and then was finally sold to the state of Ohio in the early 60s. And then this actually became the governor's airplane for the state of Ohio from 1961 till 1983. This was Governor James Rhodes' airplane for almost 30 some years. And the really neat thing about that, James Rhodes was a huge proponent of general aviation. So when he was the governor of Ohio, he had a program to put an airport in every county in the state of Ohio. And he was very successful in that campaign. What's really neat is this airplane here actually did the ribbon cutting ceremony at a lot of those airports. So this was the first airplane to land at a lot of the county airports in Ohio.
And I know that you've had the privilege to use the airplane and share it with some of the greatest generations and the World War II veterans who are part of it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So whenever we go to these air shows and different events, just like every other warbird, you know, other than telling the World War II story, we also want to honor the World War II veterans. So whenever we actually get to have a World War II vet come out and get to see the airplane, it's really special for us. Again, I don't care what they did. We just want to tell that story. But when we get a crew member or a C-47 pilot or someone that flew on DC-3s in World War II, it's that much more special because it's something they did. It's personal to them. It's near and dear to their heart. And they get to go sit in it one more time and get to hear it, get to see it, you know. And watching the expression on their faces as they walk on this thing and get to sit in their seat again, they're right there again. It's 80 years ago, you know, and they're 19 or 20 years old and like that, you know, and the stuff that comes back to them and that they say and tell us about, you got to wonder how many, you know, decades that memory sat with cobwebs on it. And this airplane was the key to unlocking that drawer, you know, or that door. And, you know, we would let them do their thing and talk, and their family members were sitting next to them. And, you know, they would walk out and say, I never heard that story before. And it's all because of this airplane that they were able to tell that story again and relive that experience. And unfortunately, it's kind of sad, you know, half the veterans we met this summer have passed away already in the short time that, you know, we got to do that with them. And it just makes it that much more meaningful that we have their signature in the airplane on the side of the cabin now. And we got that documented, hopefully for all time, you know, but the airplane's doing its job and it's, you know, one last time going out and saying thank you and giving them an opportunity to see it one more time. So it's really special. When people say that I put my blood, sweat, and tears into this airplane, that's an understatement. You know, buying any airplane and owning any airplane, it takes a lot of commitment on that individual's part, you know, whether it's a J3 Cub or a Cessna 172 or this. Starting this organization, I wanted a 501c3 nonprofit because I wanted to have a historical foundation. But to get this up and running, you know, you need a chunk of capital to get things moving. And it's really hard to get people to invest and believe in you if you don't even believe in yourself, right? So a lot of the initial money that was put down to start this organization and to purchase the aircraft was out of my own pocket. I think I was telling you before, and I'm not ashamed to say it, I went broke buying this airplane. I mean, just the down payment on this thing alone, maybe it was naive to think that I could go ahead and do it, but we're managing to make it work. But I wiped my savings account out for the down payment on this airplane. I literally did not have a dollar to my name after I put the down payment on this airplane. But we just kept going forward, and I kept, you know, trying to show people how passionate I was about it and prove to them that if they believed in me, I would make this work. And I think part of that was even for myself to try and convince myself I did the right thing, you know. But there was a lot of sacrifice that went into just saving this airplane. And that wasn't even to get it to the point where it is right now. That was just to buy it, you know. But a lot of people did believe in it. And I think that, you know, my heart came through a lot with discussing it to people and explaining what we were doing, that they wanted to help out. Like I said, this is the end result of a lot of people believing in me and my dreams and what I set out to do.
Is it worth it?
Yes. Yes, it is. There are times where it is a lot of stress, you know, personally, financially. I still put a lot of money into it to make it work. We do get donations and contributions, but without the core group of people, myself being one of them, you know, this airplane doesn't go anywhere, you know. It's definitely worth it, especially, like I said, when I get to take it out and you get a World War II vet that comes on, or you get a young kid that comes aboard and is just awestruck by it. And anytime I see this airplane go through the sky or hear it in the air, it's where it deserves to be. It's where it needs to be, you know. And yes, like I said, there's not a day that goes by I wouldn't take back what I did. I just hope that when the time comes that I can't do this anymore, that we have propped up enough younger people and have trained enough younger people to want to take the reins and keep this going. You know, the world that we live in anymore, each year it gets more and more difficult to maintain and operate these airplanes. And I really hope that this goes far beyond me, but it's just making sure that next generation is ready to take that job over. That's the hard part right now.
You mentioned you've had a few success stories. I think one of them is Joe Matz. You know, he's 26 and he's in here working with you. He's your director of maintenance. And then you mentioned the girl that's in middle school, high school?
Yeah, middle school, yeah.
Can you just share a couple of those stories?
Sure. Joe, who's my director of maintenance and my vice president of the organization, you know, he's 26 years old and going to be 27 here shortly. And when I met Joe, he just came down one day when we were in Ohio. We had just started working on the airplane. I forget how he said he had heard about us, but he met us at the fly-in the one year when we had like a little booth set up. And he's like, hey, I wanted to come down and help. What can I do? So we just paired him off with an A&P and said, here's what we're going to do today and let's get to work. And, you know, fast forward 7 years later and he's my vice president and an A&P mechanic and knows this airplane inside and out better than most people do. And I fully trust Joe with his decision-making abilities, and he's worked a lot of miracles in keeping this airplane flying and keeping it safe.
And you mentioned Sophia. Can you share a little bit of her story?
Sure. So Sophia Breichenbach is the daughter of John Breichenbach. John's one of my members, also an A&P mechanic. John and I actually work together at Republic Airways. John's a aircraft inspector and supervisor for our maintenance program there in Pittsburgh. Sophia started coming up with him about 3 or 4 years ago. She's just a little kid and just interested in airplanes. And at first she started off just, you know, hanging out in the back of the hangar, coloring book and stuff. And every once in a while she'd come over and see what we were doing. And lo and behold, 3 years later, she has her own big toolbox in the back of the hangar. And anytime we're working on it, she's right there with us getting her hands dirty. And she wants to learn. You know, she's very passionate about not only being an A&P mechanic, but keeping warbirds flying. So, and she's the future of this stuff. You know, if we can't pass this on and this knowledge on and this passion on to the next generation, you know, these airplanes aren't going to fly. And I think that part of the problem with some organizations is they don't want to take the time to teach younger people because it's a nuisance or it's a bother. And, you know, I was turned away from an organization or two even when I was a kid because, you know, people don't know how passionate or serious you are about this stuff. And it's just, they're busy, they're doing things, I get that. But you never know, taking that 2 minutes to talk to somebody and actually just sharing with them what you're doing, what kind of fire that can ignite to spark their passion to want to pursue their dreams.
But you don't just have Sophia in here polishing the airplane. You mentioned that she was in the tail for you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So she, like I said, you know, a lot of other organizations will hand you a rag and say, hey, go clean this. And after about the third or fourth time of doing that, you'll never see them again, you know. But no, we had her in the back, and when we needed to pull the horizontal stabilizer out, we actually had her putting sockets and wrenches on the other side of the bolts so that, you know, we could work together and pull the horizontal stabilizer off. She's the only one that would fit back there, but when we asked if she'd be willing to do it, she was more than anxious to go back there. And we told her how there were probably girls not much older than her during World War II, you know, the Rosies, that put this in. So for her to go and be the second young girl that was probably back there in 80 some years, that's something she's really proud of. So much so that she signed her name on the inside of the airplane back there. So she said that the next young girl that goes back there will see that she was there. So it's really cool.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit about the nose art?
So the airplane is pretty much restored exactly the way it was when it was in North Africa in 1942, 43. And all the research we did on the airplane, never had a name. It was always just a blank, you know, transport. All the markings you see on here is exactly how it looked, but we just never found any pictures where it had a name to it. So I always called the airplane, you know, the baby. I'm like, hey, I'm gonna go out and work on the baby this weekend and stuff. And somebody, I forget who it was, just said, oh, the Beach City Baby. I was like, man, that has a really cool sound to it. So I said, you know, we really ought to paint some nose art on this thing and give it an identity. And that Beach City Baby name kind of stuck. So then we needed to find something to paint on there, some type of nose art. And obviously, being, you know, a warbird aficionado and watching Memphis Belle hundreds of times, it's like, well, we got to find a pinup to put on there, you know. And we found one that kind of fit the beach theme, but again, we were afraid of copyright infringement and stealing somebody else's work. So Chad Hill stepped in with Django Studios, and Chad said, why don't I do a period era correct pinup, but make it to the likeness of your fiance Emily. And he said, if she's okay with it, I'd be happy to do that. So I asked her and she was all for it. So Chad used a picture of her face and went to work, and that's what he came up with. And we fell in love with it immediately. We're like, oh, that looks perfect. You know, it matches the color of the scheme of the airplane. And he did that rendering. And then when the time came, once the airplane was painted, he came out here. It took him a couple days. We set the scaffolding up for him, and yeah, he painted that on there for us. He also, per our request, painted all the original crew members that we found in World War II, painted their names underneath their positions on the airplane. So Jack Bartlett, Sidney Little, and John Filatico, they're all painted underneath their positions, honoring the original crew that we found on the airplane. So
that's awesome.
Yep. Just like every other, you know, museum, air museum out there, we rely heavily on donations. You know, none of us are independently wealthy. I cannot stress enough how greatly we would appreciate anyone's contributions and donations. Again, you know, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, but as you can see, you know, we love this airplane. And this thing is just the heart and soul of what we all do on the weekends, and it means a lot to us. We've been able to do a lot with what we've been given. And I think if people continue to believe in us and our mission, that this is just the beginning of what I'm trying to create up here. So, you know, we can visit our website, vintagewingsinc.com, and there's a donate button on there, or we have a P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 414, Washington, PA, and you can send a check there. Again, it's all tax deductible.
If you could just briefly describe what it feels like to fly this thing.
Sure. I've been fortunate in my aviation career. I've gotten to fly warbirds before. Believe it or not, I was flying a DC-4 before I ever found this thing. And I had close to 1,000 hours in DC-4s. So I remember getting hired at Republic Airways when I first got hired there. And I think I had 600 or 700 hours in DC-4s. And the guy's like, how do you have that much four engine time? And I was like, oh, well, you know, I was flying a DC-4. He's like, what's a DC-4? It's like, oh man. So then you have to explain that, you know, but flying a modern era jet, you know, type rated aircraft, like a Embraer 175, where everything's quiet and dark concepts and, you know, glass cockpit. Then you go back to this. This, to me, they're both amazing airplanes in their own regard, right? But flying this airplane is what I always thought being a pilot would be. You know, all the notoriety and the lore that come with the DC-3, right? You know, you get up there and there's just levers and pulleys and switches everywhere, and you're high up off the ground, and you start that engine up and the whole thing shudders to life, and you smell the oil and the avgas and the hydraulic fluid, and she's just shaking and rattling, and you're like, wow, I'm flying a freight train. You know, it's like, this is a steam locomotive in the air. You know, nothing beats when that tail comes up off the ground and that thing leaves the ground. It is just the most stable, true airplane I've ever flown in my life. There's a reason that there's as many of these still flying 80 years later. You know, it really is a love affair. And I think anyone that's flown a DC-3 or even ridden in one will attest that it's just, you don't forget it. You know, I'm still smiling right now. You know, I love it. I love that thing. She's something else. And like I said, flying her is as close to the pureness of flight as I could possibly describe.
All right, so you guys were up there, but did you get to fly in it?
No, didn't get to fly in it, but I got to see them remove a rudder and check on some corrosion,
cool.
A very minor corrosion back there in some of the sub-assemblies. But that airplane is just meticulous, Ian. Like all the hoses, the fire sleeve hoses are just all brand new. In all the plumbing, it's just an amazing amount of wiring and plumbing. And it's a DC-3 is a big airplane, no matter how you
cut it.
You know, we were talking about B-17s earlier, but, you know, B-17 is a bit bigger than a DC-3, but a DC-3 is no midget either.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of love and a lot of people that came together and a lot of young people that came together with Jason to help restore that Beach City baby.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, David, hey, I think that's it for this week. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hansen.
I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at alpa.org/hangertalk and wherever you get your podcasts, and also on YouTube.
All right. We'll see you.
See you next time, Ian.
Hangar Talk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.